Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. In last week's by-elections, we saw people making a choice. The voter had to decide. But in a world where we are bombarded with information, how do we make any choice? And how can we be sure that we're making that choice freely? In this last episode of Series 4, I wanted to dig deep into the psychology of choice, and particularly political choice. So I am really delighted to say that I'm joined by the authors of a new book, Free Your Mind, The New World of Manipulation and How to Avoid It. And they are journalist, author and photographer Laura Dodsworth and behavioural scientist Patrick Fagan. Hello to you both.
Hello, hi. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Great pleasure. Well, the honour is all mine. The book is absolutely tremendous. It's got so many juicy little details in it. So I hope people go out and buy it, not just for what you're saying about politics, but you talk about sex and you talk about advertising and you talk about people's activity on social media. So there's a lot there. But I wanted to start with the fact that your book dropped into my lap around about the time of an episode of Question Time. And the audience had been asked who supported the Rwanda scheme of sending asylum seekers by plane, to Rwanda. And not a single member of that audience, which apparently included many conservative voters, not a single member of that audience raised their hand. And this was dissected in the days afterwards as evidence of how bad the policy is. Whereas in my world of psychology, what I thought I was watching was an example of something that you two talk a lot about in your book, which is groupthink and the herd instinct, how humans are influenced by the behavior and therefore the thoughts of other people around them. And I wondered what both of you had made of that scene, that episode of Question Time.
Well, I think from a psychological point of view, there's potentially two things going on there. One, of course, is social conformity. So there's a famous experiment called the Ash experiment, where a participant was brought into a room with some other participants, and they had to answer some quiz questions out loud. And they were very, very easy questions. So they'd be shown a line and asked which of these other three lines was the same length, for example. Now, what the original participant didn't know was actually the other participants were actors who'd been trained to give what was obviously the wrong answer. And in about 75% of cases, the participant would give up the wrong answer just to go along with the rest of the group. And so that's not to make a comment on the Rwandan policy, of course, but just when there's something that's quote unquote the wrong answer that you could feel foolish or be ostracized for, you're less likely to speak up and to say something. Number one, because you think, well, if everyone else thinks this, then it must be the right thing to think. And number two, because you could be ostracized and embarrassed for saying it, of course. And then the second thing could potentially, of course, be media bias, that there's a certain bubble, epistemic bubble, a certain reality, a way of viewing the world that the media class live in. And so when they're recruiting an audience for a show, even if they do strive for some kind of balance, that bias can still seep through. And so they're not potentially representing the whole diversity of opinion in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with both of you. I mean, I just had nothing. First of all, unfortunately, I missed this episode of Newsnight. If you've read the book, you'll know we have a chapter where we recommend turning off your TV. I watch a lot less TV news than I used to. That said, sometimes I watch Newsnight, but we were deep in
late night TV.
Late night news TV, yeah. I would think that this sort of groupthink is particularly being exploited against people. It always has been, but maybe more so than ever. And that theme of polarization as well is running through so many political conversations at the moment. And there's a sort of a false binary that's presented, and I think it's done deliberately in order to quell dissent and debate on subjects like this. I mean, I don't really know what I think about a lot of these news items myself. I try to keep my own emotion out of it. But commenting on what I see happening, you know, the binary in this case with the Rwanda scheme will be that good people will welcome unlimited numbers of migrants and don't want them deported or taken to another country under any circumstances. But if you ask a question, then you're a bad person. Similarly, say in the climate debate, you see the term climate denier. So what follows on from polarization is atrocity accusations. You know, you accuse the other side of being really bad people, and that makes it even harder to speak up. You know, when the term climate denier is used, it's supposed to recall, you know, evoke the idea of Holocaust denial, which would be the ultimate horror. So people are being deliberately put into camps, a false moral binary where it's very hard to ask a question in case you're accused of being a bad person. And it sounds like that audience was a particular example of that.
And it's also about narratives, isn't it? I mean, we're speaking 1 week on from three by-elections where each party claimed that they had won a prize, which I suppose technically they did, in that each party got a seat. But we saw the spin and the attempts to shape the narrative, which is so much of what your book is about, is the way, you know, the way in which algorithms on social media, for example, shape the narrative, shape what you're shown and how that might influence you. How can voters, let's say in the immediate aftermath of this, of these by-elections, how can voters start to cut through what is so obviously the political spin?
Patrick's ex-Cambridge Analytica, so yeah. he should lead on this one, I think.
Yes. So screens really screens, whether it's smartphones or TVs or even newspapers as a kind of screen, they build our perception of reality. So if I were to ask people to picture New York in their heads, everyone could do it, even if, you know, many people have never actually been to New York. So that view of reality, that view of the world, is being constructed from somewhere, usually through screens. And of course, it's the same way through in politics, as you're talking about, this narrative building. As for how people can step away from that and resist that, there's a few things. One thing is we interviewed a magician for the book, and we asked him, if you don't want to get tricked by a magician, what should you do? And his answer was very simple. He said, don't go to the circus.
Don't go to the show. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is a certain element of stepping back. There's a saying, if you hang around in a barber's long enough, sooner or later you'll get a haircut. So if you are kind of being deluged by all this information, these persuasion attempts, they probably will get to you eventually. And so that's one of the recommendations in our book, is to, you don't have to stop watching TV forever, but just watch it maybe a bit less, or watch it a bit more mindfully, the same with social media. And of course, it's important to be an informed decision and be socially active, of course, but you can consume this information in a more mindful way, so you're not deluged with it constantly. But also the medium through which you consume it is important. So when you consume it through image, or particularly video, it's a much more emotional type of consumption. It kind of bypasses your conscious defenses, the watchdogs of the mind, as some people put it. Yes, it's just a lot more emotional and persuasive. Whereas if you're reading, say you read a broadsheet once a week, at the weekend, rather than watching the nightly news every day, that gives you time to reflect upon what you're reading and digest it and think about it in a slower, deeper way, rather than the kind of superficial, emotional content in video or even TikToks or tweets. I was just going to add one final thing is you can get immunity from these kind of techniques. For example, of course, reading a book is a bit like a vaccine in a way. If you can recognize the techniques that would be used in these adverts and campaigns, you're less likely to be influenced by them.
Well, talking of books, I mean, Laura, you've written another book. You wrote a book after COVID, and it's called A State of Fear: How the UK Government Weaponized Fear During the COVID-19 Pandemic. And again, it was something where you wanted to drill down more deeply into something that you had observed around the way in which the narrative was presented in order to shape behavior. And I asking you, Laura, what do you think is happening politically now, not just these by-elections, because that's clearly a very typical way for parties to react, but we're maybe just over 12 months out from a general election. Where do you think the politicians are going to be trying to influence us? What are the sore spots, if you like? If COVID-19 that you wrote your book about was a massive sore spot, what are the sore spots do you see ahead that the politicians are perhaps going to try and influence us around?
Yeah, well, there's a few things to come back to on there. The big answer is emotion, first of all, so emotion, culture wars, but I'll come back to that. I'll kind of bookmark that because I wanted to respond to a couple of other things. In Patrick's last answer, I concur with everything he said. Obviously, you know, we wrote the book together. And on that, it's over 300 pages of ways that people can learn to recognise and resist the psychological tactics that are not just in the politician's armory, but the big brand, the car salesman, the manipulative person in your life, the charity who wants more money from you. It's everybody. It's not just about government politics, although that's what we're talking about today. So don't go to the show. That's a really important method. Just don't look at the manipulation if you don't want to be manipulated. And then Patrick and I both mentioned the techniques that we outline in the book, which once you learn to see them, you can't unsee them. If the magician showed you his trick, you'd always know how to spot it again through, you know, if any other magician performed it in front of you. But there is a third thing, and it's what the book starts with, which is accept you're at war. And it's quite strong martial language, because if you accept there are lots of attempts to manipulate you going on, you can almost have a dialogue in your own head. We started the book with people who were trained in how to resist and also deliver enhanced interrogation techniques. And one psychological principle which they do on steroids is when you are being manipulated, tell yourself you won't be manipulated. So you can have this kind of internal dialogue where you recognize it's happening, you say, but I can resist. And that will help everyone in these crazy times of propaganda and political machinations on steroids. So the reason I wrote A State of Fear was I was so shocked at how fear, behavioural science, nudge and propaganda were deployed to induce compliance with what were very draconian lockdown rules. Now, I'm not ideologically neutral or politically neutral. If you wear that book, you'll see that my colours are nailed to the mast. I didn't think lockdown was a good idea. It wasn't evidence-based. Same goes for masks. But whatever you think about the situation we were in and what the right solutions were, the question is, do you think it was right to use fear to control people? That hasn't gone anywhere. We see it now all the time. Politicians lean on fear almost reflexively. And I'm not saying it's new, but I'm saying they're doing it a lot. When Matt Hancock's WhatsApp messages were leaked to The Telegraph, something that was quite astonishing was him talking about deploying the new variant, that was the Kentish variant, to, in quotes, scare the pants off everyone. And it was quite interesting at the time what reactions to that were. I mean, some people were horrified, but there was also a lot of cognitive dissonance, a lot of doubling down. Oh, he didn't really mean it. Or, oh, but it was frightening. You know, this was our Minister of Health and Social Security talking about frightening people to make them follow the rules again. So I think that
are you worried? I mean, that was a very particular set of circumstances, the like of which the world hadn't seen for a very long time. And my question to you about the general election, do you have a fear, talking about fear, do you have a fear that something of that magnitude, or sorry, something as innocuous as a policy, a government policy or an opposition policy, could be weaponized in advance of a general election to try to bring more of the electorate on side?
Well, political propaganda always draws on hopes and fears. Think back to the Obama campaign. It was simply his face with the word hope on it. I mean, that's the most blatant example of hope. Fear, we see it all the time with Donald Trump putting up a wall to protect the country from migrants. So I don't necessarily foresee a particular policy, but the language that we use is the language of emotion, which is why we'll see culture wars rising up to the forefront. Because the truth is, you can't really put a piece of paper between many of the policies. I mean, I'm left totally politically discombobulated and politically agnostic. I don't really think left and right is a very useful paradigm anymore. And I think a lot of people feel the same way, which is why they're talking in the language of emotion, and fear is the most powerful of the emotions to deploy. You see it with climate change at the moment. So to encourage people to decarbonize their lifestyles, I would wager there is a very deliberate program of fear to make people softened up for policies. It's why a lot of heat wave hysteria is being encouraged. So whatever policies are front of mind leading up to the general election, the language is that of emotion.
Well, in fact, you've also called it elsewhere in your book as the information battlefield. So again, it's that language of it being about a war. There is so much at stake. And Patrick, what do you think each party needs to do? Look, after the by-elections, Rishi Sunak said, you know, it's not a done deal. The Conservatives are saying the general election is not a done deal, and the Labour are saying we're not complacent. What do you think, from a behavioural scientist point of view, that each party needs to do in terms of what you both in the book, or rather David Halpin from the Nudge Unit, called that radical incrementalism? What do you think parties need to do to get the electorate to vote for them?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because to answer it, I feel like I have to kind of flip the book and explain what techniques they should use to get to win
votes. I'm sure they're listening, so definitely go ahead.
There's a few things. First of all, of course, there's a loyal base who they need to kind of energize and get them to go out and spread the word, and of course to vote, you know, to kind of get out the vote campaign. And that's where some of these culture wars things come in, but in particular making the base feel like they're being kind of attacked in some way by the other side, as it were, this kind of us versus them techniques. Then they would also need to kind of splinter and demoralize the people who would vote for the other candidate and would never have a chance of winning their vote. So that's where you kind of do negative campaigning about the opposition candidate, but you do it on things not that your base would care about, but that their base would care about. And then the really key people are the swing voters, or the persuadables, or the in-betweeners. And so it would be really key to do some research to find out what are their, essentially their kind of repressed desires and anxieties and so on, and create a campaign that's going to resonate with that and the steam in that drives behavior. And so find out what that emotion is and kind of heat it up, get it all vibrating so that they'll go out and vote for your candidate. So it's that, in a nutshell, is a case of segmenting the electorate and using different psychological techniques on each. But I can see Laura's face. Yeah.
But the thing is, for me, this is what's become really detestable about politics. You know, since the Nudge Unit was formed, especially, the process of radical incrementalization and incrementalism and behavioral science has ruined politics. And this is what I mean about, once you see the tricks, you can't unsee them. I don't want them to use emotion or to splinter us. People, we've got to a stage where people don't know what they're voting for, because their emotions are being played like puppets on a string. So one study we mentioned in the book found that when people in the US watched a lot of news that showed law and order problems, they put law and order at the top of their list of priorities that they want from politicians. So we end up in a feedback loop where the whole relationship with government has changed. It used to be a lot more transactional. They'd have a manifesto, we vote for them, they deliver it. But now they use our taxes to wage campaigns of nudge and propaganda against us, so that we vote for them and they sneak in the policies they want. I just find it really repellent. I accept I'm probably in a minority, but I think more and more people are becoming alive to the artificiality in the messages and the use of emotion and feel politically homeless. I would vote in a heartbeat for a government that promised to put its behavioural science budget on a manifesto.
I should say, I'm not kind of condoning those techniques, unless, of course, the political party has lots of money they want to give me. But I think in the long run, I mean, things are so kind of chaotic and fluid at the minute. What would really, in the long run, help a politician is just to have some principles and values and standards and stick by them consistently.
And values is a really important one. And one of the areas of the book that I was really struck by was, as you say, you've got lots and lots of techniques for resisting the influence that people, organizations, states, governments are trying to have around us. And one of those techniques was meditation, particularly for the way in which it can center you and allow you to tune in more to your gut response, to your gut feel about something. So I just wondered, I mean, I hope this doesn't sound too fanciful. I don't mean to be flippant, but do you think we should all meditate before voting?
I think that's a really interesting idea. Don't wait till just before you cast your ballot. It's too late by then. Meditation sounds like such a twee recommendation. I should say we've got more surprising ones in the book, but there's a couple of reasons why it's useful to meditate. First of all, it's shown to help de-bias you, get you more in touch with your gut instinct. And secondly, if you practice a very deep form of meditation called analytic meditation, you can understand yourself better. And if you understand yourself better, you are less susceptible to propaganda and messaging of any sort, because half of the problem is the message, but half of the problem is you. It knows how to play upon your fears, your desires, your foibles, and your own unique emotional landmines. We call it self-haunting in the book. So you need to stop haunting yourself. You need to get to know yourself. It's the work of a lifetime. One thing I've changed in my life is I've introduced some daily meditation and prayer into my life, because I feel like it centers me every day. And I tell you what, before I do interviews as well, I take that time, because I get into myself and I remember, what are my values? So I'm less likely to be swayed by any emotion on the spur of the moment or what anyone else says or their values. I really do recommend meditating before voting. But like I said, don't leave it to the day of the general election. Start now.
Patrick?
Yeah, absolutely. I also meditate myself. I think it's really useful for two reasons. One is that it puts you in touch with your emotions and your senses a bit more and your gut instinct. So you can become more aware of when your emotional strings are being pulled. And secondly, it allows you to kind of let go of negative thought patterns or emotions. So if a piece of propaganda has implanted some kind of us versus them feeling of resentment, for example, meditation allows you just to kind of let go of that and go back to more of a neutral state.
So that's three of us are meditating on a daily basis, which has got to be a good thing, I have to say.
But conversely, if you're always on your phone or in the future on your Apple Vision, it's the opposite of meditation. Your mind is constantly being pulled into a hive mind and into distractions and likes and shares. And that's the danger, I think, for people now, social media, and in increasingly, a world that's increasingly saturated by big tech.
Yes, and overnight there's been calls to ban phones in schools because they recognise the negative impact that's having on that particular generation. But obviously, like you, I would argue that downtime, that lack of screen time, reduction in screen time is going to be beneficial for anybody, whatever their age. I just want to pop back to something that Laura said when you were talking, Laura, about how words and language and influence is weaponized. And your reference was to, for example, I think you were alluding to the wildfires coverage, you know, the dreadful fires that we've been seeing photographically from the Mediterranean, but maybe how that had been ramped up as one particular angle of the narrative. If we assume that in the general election, the issue of net zero or green energy, not least because it was a rather large angle in the Uxbridge by-election, one might argue that the ULEZ topic was partly around a net zero, even though it was not just about climate change, but it was more about, I suppose, clean air. How can parties speak to the electorate in less inflammatory terms, in more realistic terms, about the transition maybe to cleaner energy? Patrick first.
Sorry, how can they communicate this information, you mean?
Exactly. How can they speak to the electorate? Because Laura said just then, you know, I would vote for a party in a way that was more ethical, that was more transparent, that wasn't trying to practice the sort of engagement of fear. So how can we do it without fear?
So I'm a big believer in the wisdom of crowds, and that if you give people the information and if you're true and transparent, eventually the crowd as a whole, the very complex network kind of organism in itself, will come to the best solution. And it might be a bit messy and noisy, and it might take a while, but it will get there in the end. This kind of enormous hive mind of competing interests and so on tends to work out for the best in the end. So it might be a bit difficult at first, a bit messy, but really it's just communicate the information truthfully and transparently.
Laura?
Yes, the DAO of crowds and the DAO of everything. So I don't think that the hope is for our current leaders to communicate things differently. I think the problem that we have is that leaders don't trust us. I mean, no wonder trust in institutions, the media and government is low, at historic lows, and it's because they don't trust us. They don't trust us. Why would we trust them? We don't have a trusting relationship. They don't think people will vote for a party that wants to get rid of cars, gas boilers, not travel on holiday, and who can blame them? I'm not voting for that either. So instead they try sneaky methods. So with ULEZ, this is a form of incrementalism. It started with congestion charge, then ULEZ, then widening ULEZ, and now Labour is saying it'll come to every town and city, and Sadiq Khan's saying he wants to trial a cost per mile. They don't tell you where this is going, which is they want, well, I think about 75% of us or something I saw in a document, not to drive. Because that's not a vote winner. They're doing it by incrementalism. So I think that asking this current set of political leaders to communicate differently isn't the point. What it is they'd have to respect democratic mandates and the ability of the individual to know what's best for them. You know, if you're talking about trusting minds, you can also trust markets. We wouldn't have to be making it almost impossible for people to sell homes without an EPC rating of C, like the current proposals in Scotland, to make them switch to a heat pump if heat pumps were actually good, reliable and affordable. So I think that the question is that they need to not change how they communicate, but change how they think about our minds, and instead to respect the great unwashed, to know what's best for them.
Well, that's the irony, isn't it? You're both really talking about the way in which politicians don't trust the electorate, but the electorate clearly doesn't trust the politicians either, because the polling suggests that there's a rather large a plague on all your houses view of politicians. And in your book, Free Your Mind, The New World of Manipulation and How to Avoid It, you talk about this paper where people are more accepting of moral discretion, indiscretions when they're small. And I wondered, how can we get back to a stage where both the politicians, because you've got this rather strange dynamic, haven't you? When you vote, you're in effect infantilizing yourself, because you're saying, I'm kind of giving you my vote, that's my power. But I'm basically saying, I'm going to give my power away to the politicians. So how can we get to a stage, if ever, where that balance is more equal, that it isn't the electorate being infantilized so that the politicians can be all powerful? Do you see that there's a way in which it could be more balanced? Maybe Patrick first.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I have this concept I call the long march away from the institutions. And it's about people essentially taking more responsibility in their own lives, which can be difficult, of course, and there's risk involved as well. So generally speaking, we like to and need to submit to some kind of institutional community and so on. But what we have currently clearly isn't working. So I think there needs to be a case of stepping away, what is known as the parallel polis, in Power of the Powerless, the parallel system, creating your own economies. For example, okay, conservatives may be getting debanked, you know, shut out from banks. That's bad, but why don't we set up our own banks? I mean, surely Nigel Farage has enough contacts and resources to do that. So it's about stepping away and creating something new. And then the second point is that, as I alluded to, we all need to submit to something, some kind of doctrine, institution, community, whatever it might be, because the universe is infinitely big. There's an infinite amount of choice out there, and we can't consciously, carefully process it all to come to our decisions. So we have to kind of outsource some of our decision making. I think part of the problem is the things we used to outsource our decision making to, we no longer trust or follow. So I'm talking, of course, about religions, community, and we're entering into this kind of state of chaos and fluidity where even gender isn't fixed anymore, according to some people. So everything's kind of fluid. So the problem, I think, is maybe we shouldn't give our control, our responsibility, not outsource it to politicians. I think they're possibly some of the worst people to be outsourcing our behavior to. Religions might be a bit better, but of course, you know, they're not perfect. But there has to be some kind of more moral and structured and sustainable kind of system that we can outsource our decision making to than politics, I would think.
Laura.
Okay, so I'm going to throw in a bit of sex here, because no one's asked us about our sex chapter. We were so prepared for people to be cross about the sex chapter and questions about it.
That's my other that's the other hack I wear. Maybe we can do a podcast on that.
Let's do a sex podcast. So the thing is, we draw a parallel in that chapter about, which is called Don't Be a Slave to Sex, between BDSM, that's bondage, dominance, sadomasochism. I never remember what the letters stand for, BDSM, and an unhealthy relationship with the state. Now, although it's our own parallel, we didn't get there first. Eric Fromm, the fantastic psychologist and writer, wrote about it in The Art of Loving. And it really speaks to what our book is actually about. So if I just go back a couple of steps, if society's in free fall, if we've lost trust in institutions, in politicians, if we're being bombarded with manipulation, you can't fix everything else. I'd love to have an answer on how to fix politics. I know that when I vote, I don't want to give the politicians very much of my power at all. In fact, I want to be giving away a lot less power. I want it to be a much more transactional, simplified relationship than I feel we have now with the state. But you can't fix all of the institutions. You can't even fix the people around you. You can't fix politics. You have to start with yourself. And one reason we refer back to those great thinkers from the World War period, Jung, Fromm, is they talk about this principle of self-individuation. So this is where you have to start with freeing your mind. If we think about your hierarchy of needs, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, he puts clean air, water, food at the bottom. I fundamentally disagree with that. I think free thinking is at the bottom. If you can eat and drink water, but you don't know how to think for yourself, you're essentially a slave. You must know how to filter and control information that is given to you and to think for yourself as far as you can. You know, no man is an island. We're not all free of influence. I'm no paragon of virtue either. So you start with yourself, because good communities and good institutions are made up of good individuals. Take good to mean what you want. So in a BDSM relationship, both the slave and the master are abnegating themselves. They're giving themselves over to a dynamic which some people might call unhealthy. They bleed into each other. They lose their sense of self. And it's the same thing with a state which is too large and overdeveloped, the totalitarian state. That's where you get these infantilized people, where they're looking to the state for every single answer in their life. They cannot move unless the state tells them. The problem is, we think of those states as being over there in other countries, bad countries. But I think increasingly in this country, we are an infantilized nation. If you think about the example of COVID again, which we've given the book a couple of times, people were literally asking politicians, are we allowed to hug each other again? You know, if you're at the stage where you're asking about the very most, you know, the most basic aspects of human relationships, you're asking your politicians for far too much. So I think where I've come to after several years of personal existential crisis since March 2020 is that you have to start with yourself, be sovereign of your own mind. Mm. If everyone does that, the rest will flow from there.
Mm. Well, as we always say in my world of psychology, you can only really make good choices for yourself if you know yourself well. And what I would say is that I knew myself well enough to know that this book, Free Your Mind, The New World of Manipulation and How to Avoid It, was really important, and I really needed to get the two of you on my podcast. So to my On the Couch listeners, thank you for your company during series four. I'll see you after the summer break. Meanwhile, a massive thank you to Laura Dodsworth and Patrick Fagan. Thank you both for being such stimulating guests on the Couch.
Thank you.